You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more. Today on our show, I'm talking with Jonathan Geyer. He's calling in from Cairo, Egypt. Jonathan, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Brainerd. Thanks for having me.
So, Jonathan, I'm calling you on November 9th. Of course, this is the day after this extraordinary upset in America. And while I want to talk about your writing and your work with comics and in Egypt and internationally, it's hard to avoid the topic of the election now. So perhaps you can tell me a little bit about what you're seeing from there, if it seems appropriate, and how you've spent the last 12 or 24 hours, and what the reaction is there, or parallels between between what's going on in Trump and Egypt.
Sure. Well, I mean, I'm just as shocked as everybody by the election result. I was the Nile Ritz-Carlton was hosting a U.S. Embassy watching party until midnight last night, which was still no result. So we came back at 7:30 a.m. this morning, and the ambassador gave the U.S. ambassador to Egypt gave these remarks about how there will be a smooth transition to power and Egypt will remain important to America, which, you know, normally wouldn't be so remarkable, but given this rupture of a Trump presidency, really kind of struck a chord. I guess the one surprising thing, Brainerd, is there's a great affinity for Donald Trump here in Egypt among many Egyptians I spoke to, which initially sounded peculiar, but he's tough on terrorism, he's tough on Islamic radicalism, which resonates strongly here. And even just on a personal level, he has a kind of connection with the former general Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who's the president. So they met at the United Nations General Assembly in September and had a kind of rapport, much to all of our surprise. And there is a kind of, I don't know, it's too soon, obviously, to be critical of a Trump presidency, but the similar kind of clumsiness on the foreign stage and a kind of rambunctiousness in their approach to personal politics more generally. But obviously, it's been a sleepless night here, too, and just totally flabbergasted by the result.
And how do you account for, I mean, you touched on a number of issues where, you know, it's also very surprising to me to hear that, you know, young people there have any kind of attraction. I imagine globally, I mean, and this is, you know, my notion, but that everybody's aghast at what's happening, including young and older citizens of all countries. But you're saying even in Egypt, there's an attraction to him. And it's hard for me to imagine what attraction he holds. Even his tough line on terrorism is what is the attraction? He seems to be sort of the epitome of the kind of ugly American, I would imagine.
That's absolutely right. But there's two things to keep in mind, Brainerd. First is Hillary Clinton is immensely unpopular in Egypt and in much of the Middle East, given her militaristic, hawkish foreign policy, the failed approach to the Syria civil war, the misguided intervention in Libya, and of course the bungling and bumbling that Obama and Hillary really did in Egypt. So there's a really negative association with Hillary. And yes, although the Trump affinity is quite surprising to some, I spoke to a cartoonist last night, and he was unquestionably supportive of Trump, and in part because of his anti-terrorism sort of stance. But, you know, we're talking about a segment of society that's more conservative in general that would be at a U.S. embassy event. I would imagine the younger, more politically active folks in Egypt are equally disgusted with Hillary or Trump. And both of them really represent an establishment and ugly Americans here.
Yeah, it's fascinating and really kind of an extraordinary historical upset. So how do you think this will be received and digested there? I mean, you know, to move the conversation on to perhaps the conversation you were having or what you were discussing with the artist who is making comics, it's this kind of support for Trump. You know, again, it's hard for me to grasp as you know, though you're being very articulate about it, but even his stance on terrorism seems to be very thin. I mean, it's not that he has a policy other than, you know, just bomb the mall or stop the mall from entering the country. That's not really a policy. So how is it, how do you think it'll be digested there in the context of the critical comics, or how it will be? I guess that's projecting, but trying to move on to the world of.
Well, I mean, I've already seen comics kind of just obviously really vibrant and grotesque caricatures of Trump for the last several weeks, but also coming in this morning and this afternoon of, you know, the golden hair of Donald Trump sitting crowned on top of the globe. But, you know, of course, we don't know how cartoonists or artists will digest what a Trump presidency is, but I guess what I'm speaking to is that, all, you know, of course, his terrorism policies, his national security policies are really just bluster and have been superficially articulated. And we really have no idea what kind of appointments he would make for administration positions or what kind of substantive policy stances he would take on any of these issues. I mean, he was horrifically underprepared for the debates, but I think somehow perversely, Egyptians and people in the Middle East want change in terms of American policy, and they see Obama as a continuity of 8 years of mistaken responses to Syria and Libya and Iraq and et cetera. So that kind of narrow hope of a so-called outsider, which I don't believe Trump is an outsider, but he does put on the airs of an outsider to politics that I think people are strangely eager about.
Yeah, well, being rejected by his own party and so many Republicans makes him a bit of an outsider that way. But of course, he's you know, as big a capitalist as you could be, and aligned with a Republican Party strongly. So, how in the world of that you research and write about so much, the local comics, how do you think that writers and artists can help us all now on this global stage understand a bit of what's happening? If that's one way to look into some of the work you're doing, I imagine you'll be writing articles, perhaps addressing some of this because this is such a huge issue. But what I'm asking is the role of the comic artist in this kind of historical upset globally.
Well, I mean, I love to consider the art and the structure and the style of comic art, but there is a huge political value of it as well in the Middle East, particularly in unfree societies where comics and cartoons are kind of seen as a liminal or ephemeral space, and not taken seriously by authoritarian governments. So cartoonists, I really see as ombudsmen. Even if they don't always realize it, but often they're quite aware of that they're going much further in critiquing governments or policies or fat cats, businessmen than anyone else. In terms of what that translates for a President Trump, I mean, already the satire about him is outrageous in terms of the way that America has treated the Middle East of Iraq or Egypt aren't ready for democracy or interventions in you know, polling places. There's a lot of jokes about America not being ready for democracy, or congratulations on you know, America's democratic moment, or you know, treating the FBI intervention as the secret police having an internal fight within the government. So I think that's where satire and cartoons have a really universal message of connecting whether it's activists or artists or anyone struggling for a cause in a variety of international contexts.
And when I was reading about some of your articles, you know, to talk about comics historically, you know, it's changed so much, and it was fascinating to me to look at comics you were reproducing from the turn of the century before the advent of cameras, where cartoonists were also journalists, and in a sense, not just creating satire, but also creating very detailed and sometimes exquisite drawings that are allowing the public entree into something that they can't see otherwise, visually, visual entree. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that historic trend, but now the role of comics isn't quite the same as journalists. As you're saying, in a society that I think you termed unfree, there's a unique role, an almost subversive role. Is there no censorship also there, in terms of what cartoonists can express?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, Brainerd. Let's take it from today and move backwards. Of course, there's censorship here, and a big part of my project has been to understand what the mechanics of censorship are, because it's not like some guy in uniform crossing out lines. It's from editors, it's from the general public, it's from legal institutions, and it's of course the notion of self-censorship and the limits artists set for themselves. But there is a novelist, Ahmed Najji, in Egypt, who's in prison. There's a satirical troupe that's been imprisoned for their rabble-rousing satire. And this is the case across a variety of countries in the Middle East and North Africa. So there is always the risk of going too far, but I think that's what emboldens artists and writers and cartoonists to do much more poignant and potent work in this context, whereas the stakes sometimes don't feel as high to be a cartoonist in America. In Egypt, it's, as I say, going perhaps to the edge and even further in terms of their criticisms of a quite autocratic government. In terms of whether, I mean, I would argue that, as you suggest, I think cartoonists today still are journalists, but the role that they had in some of these 100-year-old publications is fascinating. I've just been doing quite a lot of archival work in dusty bookshops in Cairo, and found a magazine from 1925, a assassination attempt that I couldn't even find in any history books. But after really digging, I found some articles in the New York Times and elsewhere. But there was this amazing moment of an artist, kind of the style of a Harper's Weekly or New Yorker or many of the same Western European publications of the 1920s, a really vivid image of an attempted assassination. And of course, cartoons explaining what that meant for an Egyptian audience. So that's one thing I'm fascinated by, is the local history of visual cultures here, that cartoonists and illustrated press dates back to the turn of the century. And there's a whole local history deeply influenced by Ottoman publications and also French and British caricature. And that's a lot of what I've been searching through hundreds of year old publications, trying to figure out what's what.
Yeah, I saw that was the image I was actually referring to before. I believe the assassination, where you were writing about how how that ceiling was so beautifully drawn out, and I'd love to hear more about that. The dusty bookshops of Cairo sounds tremendously romantic to me, although I'm sure it's not quite what I envision. What else are you finding in these bookshops and what you're working on now?
It's a great question. I mean, I find treasures enough to fill a museum. I have a project on crime noir and serialized fiction. I'm fascinated by these really gritty covers of a lot of Hitchcock and even earlier kind of crime novels from the 30s, 40s, and 50s were translated into Arabic and have local covers that are basically disintegrating your hands sometimes, but they're gorgeous. Sometimes I'll find sort of cheesy pinups or sci-fi magazines from the US and wonder how they ended up here. But much of what I'm looking through are old periodicals and children's magazines. A lot of the great comic artists in Egypt and the Middle East started off drawing Arabized versions of Mickey Mouse or tracing versions of Superman into Arabic. So I've been finding comics from the 50s and the 60s. And while you're in these bookstalls, there's dozens of them in downtown Cairo, a whole area of really the dirtiest, smelliest, most fun to explore bookstalls, you'll find old film stills and other ephemera and French and German publications, old travel books. I have a friend who's working on a project on old cookbooks. I mean, it's basically a potpourri of adventure. And I'm particularly taken with crime novels and comics, but it might as well be, who knows what I'll find next week. It could be something totally outrageous and different.
Right, that's so exciting to hear about. So when we talk about novels, and you talk about, I mean, not novels, but comics, where read their redrawings of Superman or other figures, I would imagine there's also an entirely new tales that are spinning, right? Like here, of course, with Superman, Spider-Man, all the superheroes, there's a whole number of stories of that they can go on, but they're also continually rewritten by writers to readdress different cultural situations as we move through history. And maybe this is something that you're not approaching or are, but what I'm asking is there also comic stories of heroes that are rewritten in a context that's giving a sort of illustration of local culture there, because we're talking about like Western culture being adapted and then being reinterpreted, really, aren't we? Like Mickey Mouse and the others.
No, absolutely. I mean, Mickey Mouse in particular is really interesting because local artists were able to really go wild and create their own covers and stories. So Mickey Mouse is smoking a hookah, a water pipe on one cover, or he has a big fez or a tarboosh, that red hat and a big mustache. It doesn't look anything like the Mickey Mouse you and I would have grown up with in the States or in Europe. Superman is, I mean, Arabic is written right to left, of course. So there's a kind of translation of the text and flipping of the frame. So they were retraced right to left. And with that comes little changes. And I mean, and this is one of the things I've been researching, Brainerd, is so you have this rich history of real, what seems like straightforward cultural reappropriation or travel. But what's happening today is there's a cohort of young comic artists in their 20s and 30s who are kind of reinventing the form for adults, and kind of what Crumb and Spiegelman and many of the names we're familiar with from the Bay Area or New York in the 60s or 70s, that's happening in Egypt and Tunisia and Morocco and Lebanon right now. So they're more meta comics. They're comics about comics. They're comics where the superhero fights sexual harassment. He doesn't fight, a big, scary, ferocious villain. He fights the villains of everyday life. Or and there's a variety of zines that have come out in the past, basically 6 years since the 2011 uprisings. That's been the trajectory of comics, is a whole group of collectives of young artists who are really playing with the graphic novel. Because while there's a lot of comics for children in the Middle East historically, the graphic novel really emerges during the Lebanese Civil War in the 1980s, and then again in Mubarak's Egypt in 2007-ish. So the graphic novel is a really new form here in terms of gritty, kind of outrageous alt comics, as we would think of them in the American context.
And the old comics and zines, and I was once involved in doing some zines for a while. It's also a form, and just correct me if I'm wrong, that when we look at the art world, the commercial art world, that's particularly not as commercial. Obviously, the comics want them published, they want them bought or distributed, but it seems to be, especially with zines and comics that are produced in small editions, there's a tremendous amount of freedom, perhaps, in what they can express because they don't have commercial pressures of a gallery or a major publisher. Is that the case in the young people that you were just referencing?
Well, absolutely. Although I'll add a nuance to that. I mean, these are really horizontal, self-published, independent, periodical comics. They're great. They're totally artist-driven, and it's a huge contrast to the kind of top-down culture that is in the Egyptian Ministry of Culture, or all these official cultural spheres and palaces that really tend to dominate art and exhibits and publications in the region. But with these kind of radical self-publishing collectives, they've also kind of made a kind of fun alliance with art galleries in Cairo and art galleries in Beirut in particular. So often launch events and such will be held at some of the contemporary art galleries. They'll hold small exhibitions or discussions or conferences. So it is, in a way, I mean, this is something I've been considering now, is are comic artists just artists, or are they doing something different? And the way I come out is I think they are kind of deeply entwined in the art community in terms of all of, you know, there's a huge conceptual and experimental and contemporary and modern art scene in Egypt and the Middle East. And actually, even though comic artists often don't realize it, they're part and parcel of a lot of changes in artistic flows in the country.
Before we get to the very end of this, I feel like I should also touch upon, since we're talking in the art world, and you've also interviewed people like Marina Abramovic and Jeff Koons for a piece you did a while ago. Do you want to say anything about what you drew from those interviews with Marina and Jeff in the context of what we're talking about? Because that's, of course, now the sort of stratospheric art world, as opposed to this not underground movement, but a movement that's certainly, in contrast to those two, more marginal. Is there any comment you want to make about the two of them and the interview you did with both of them in the context of the art world that we're discussing now?
Well, thanks for asking that. I mean, that's in reference to a trip I made to Qatar, and which is this very wealthy Persian Gulf state that's invested hugely in art. And in some sense, it's a great thing that they can bring Abramovich and Koons and other starchitects and celebrity artists and introduce them to a totally different place and space for exhibition and discussion. But the thing I really wanted to draw out there is, you know, how free can art be when you're in an unfree country? Qatar, for instance, at the time I was there, was holding a poet in prison for his dissenting texts. And there's all sorts of taboos that are religious or gender-based, or, you know, Jeff Koons could never show his outrageous pornographic photographs or scenes in Qatar. And he seems okay with it. And Marina Abramovic could never do some of the outrageous stuff she's done in Europe, in Qatar. But she's trying to do something else and reach out to Qatari women. And my point wasn't to criticize them or to say they're duplicitous, but rather to ask, you know, what does that mean for local artists in the Middle East or Qatar? And what are the limits? And if you do have a Jeff Koons or a Marina Abramovic, you know, being guests of the royal family, I mean, it's quite like the Medicis in a way. And it's quite different than the kind of raw, gritty art scene that we see in Cairo. There is a huge disconnect between the hyper-wealth and hyper-technologically advanced parts of Qatar. And then, you know, there's other issues too, Brainerd. There's a well-known history of informal labor or mistreatment of laborers who've built some of these great stadiums. There's, you know, a Zaha Hadid stadium being built for the Qatari World Cup, and there's been criticism of that. I think it's been debunked, but there is credence to workers being mistreated, and it becomes real questions of, when you invest in art, is that enough, or do you also have to take seriously a whole battery of human rights and freedom of expression considerations?
Yeah, that's interesting. I remember a while ago I interviewed, I believe I'm saying her name right, Princess Ali Al-Sanusi, and who's had something of a role in bringing a lot of art to the Middle East. And she said, you know, people occasionally say to her, you know, how can you be, you know, showing all this work when there's so few rights for women? And she felt that, and other human rights abuses, and she said that this is art's role to help with those abuses, that it can have an activist role. She said it would be the equivalent of saying, you know, in the United States, oh, you know, before the civil rights movement, how can you show work there? You know, the terrible civil rights abuses. She saw art as potentially a transformative tool that could help with more expanded rights for a variety of people. Do you see it also that way in terms?
I think that's a crucial point to discuss, and that's something Marina Abramović made very clear to me. But when I saw her speak at this very blue chip New York Times conference that was somewhere near $2,000 to attend, and when I saw Jeff Koons speak, they were really, you know, if they wanted to talk about those issues, I would have greatly welcomed them. But they just took the opportunity to talk in kind of TED Talk platitudes and not really address those issues. So I do think that art does have a, whether a political or a democratic value that's worth discussing, but it needs to be discussed. You can't just show up and take a paycheck for a big speaking gig and act like one's presence is enough. So that's why I felt a responsibility while being in Qatar to ask these type of questions to Jeff Koons, for example.
And his response to that was, as opposed to Marina, who was addressing women, how did he feel about that?
I found his response, you know, somewhat dismissive, but from my perspective, this just wasn't the consideration that he was making. He was excited to be there. I mean, Ren Coolhouse was there the night before. There was, you know, it's a fun scene to be in, and he's really deified there as this great artist. And I'm sure, you know, I ran into him at the elevator, and he remembered my name. He was a really lovely guy. I enjoyed speaking with him, but there I felt like he was clasping for straws when I was really asking him, what does it mean when a poet's in jail? I mean, is there a responsibility of artists? And it's an open question. I don't purport to have the answer. You know, I don't think artists should have one role in society, of course. I mean, and I don't think artists' role need be political. It would be terrible if artists were just political. But I do think that when one goes to a country to participate in something hosted by the royal family, by a princess, by a sheikha, then, you know, who but Jeff Koons could make a strong statement in support of freedom? I mean, I saw it as a missed opportunity, but hopefully you'll have another opportunity.
I agree, and that's well said. It's been great talking with you, but before we go, I wanted to ask, as I've been asking lately in interviews, is there a book or books you're currently reading now on any topic that you'd want to share with us?
Sure. I'm reading a new study. It's based on a terrific exhibit at the Pompidou right now about a little-known movement of Egyptian surrealists, and the book is called Surrealism in Egypt by Sam Berdal, who's a curator and scholar who's explored how a group of artists in the 30s and 40s in Egypt connected and engaged with a lot of the anti-fascist, anti-imperialist, and aesthetic ideas of surrealism. So that's one, and I'd recommend that. It's just hot off the presses.
Jonathan, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.